This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I'm talking to Iris Jamal Dunkel. She's the author of a new book called Riding Like the Wind, The Life of Sonora Babb, B-A-B-B. How are you, Iris?
Great. Thanks for having me.
I was really happy to have you on. I had known about Sonora Babb, who was... had written a bunch of books, and I'd heard of her, but I never really knew her story. And I've always been interested in, you know, what we might call lost or obscured writers of the 20th century. It's a period that I'm really interested in, and it is really not uncommon for women writers to have become overlooked. So you've written a really comprehensive biography of her. I'm kind of curious to know, before we talk about Sonora herself, whose name is spelled S-A-N-O-R-A, not like the Sonora Desert, but what got you interested in her in particular, and maybe something about your background as a scholar and writer that would give this context?
Sure. So the way I found Sonora Babb was I was watching the Dust Bowl documentary by Ken Burns, and I came across this name, Sonora Babb, and this book whose names are unknown that he mentions in it. And, you know, I grew up, my grandmother came over to California in the Dust Bowl from Oklahoma, and I had read The Grapes of Wrath in high school and was really excited to, you know, tell my grandmother that they wrote a book about us. And when I told her this, she was like, "That's a terrible book. You know, don't talk about it again." You know,
the Grapes of Wrath is a terrible.
Grapes of Wrath. Yeah. Yeah. And so I was like, "Oh God, all right." And so I didn't understand why she was so upset until I read "Whose Names Are Unknown" by Sonora Babb, which is a completely different perspective on the Dust Bowl, and it helps you get to know the characters before the worst day of their lives. Like, you know that they, you know, their communities, you know them. Living in Oklahoma well before they have to give everything up and move to California. So when I discovered this book, I was thrilled. And I went on Google and searched Sonora Babb and found this website and found out she was also a poet, which I'm also a poet. And that she, you know, she wrote all these other books. And so I filled out the form on the website, and it went directly to her literary advisor, her literary executor, Joanne Dierkop. And when she found out I was a biographer, she was thrilled. And she was like, "I'll send you everything. Let's go. Let's write a..." And she pulled me in immediately. And so
wow.
I was really excited to begin the journey to work on Sonora Babb. I had already been someone writing about women who had been forgotten. So that's my area of research. I started by writing a book about Jack London's wife, Charmian Kittredge London, who helped write his novels and didn't get any credit for it. And
right.
I was really excited. The scholarship I did was used to remodel the museum at Jack London State Historic Park. So I realized that what I did as a feminist could actually change things in the physical world. And so that made me commit the rest of my career to doing this work.
Well, I've read the whole book, and I did read Whose Names Are Unknown, which I think is a really good book.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not just that you're rescuing her because she was a woman writer of that era. She was a good writer. And I think recognizably by anyone, almost everyone who reads her books. So, it's always surprising when you find out that someone who's written really well, because, you know, a lot of books are lost to history. They're not always great books. They're sometimes meaningful and important and useful and beneficial to read today. But sometimes there's a reason why books don't stand the test of time. They don't resonate as well. But her book really does. And, you know, yeah. I don't mean to sound surprised as if how could she have done that. I just mean that, it's notable that it's a really good book, and notable, therefore, that it was obscured.
I think it's important to note that, you know, many of her, she was in a writing group with Ray Bradbury for 40 years, and he recognized her work as one of the best writers he'd ever read. And I think that that shows you just how respected she was by all of her peers. Like many of her peers who went on to become famous saw in her writing something that was extraordinary. And I think that we can recognize that today when she's rediscovered.
Would you say, maybe I don't want to put words in your mouth, but reading the book, you get the really strong feeling that she did set aside her writing career
for her husband, James Wong.
Yeah. And other things too, for her sister, that she was, the representative of what happens often to women who end up being caregivers.
Yeah.
And supporters.
I think it's important to recognize that, Sonora Babb was an incredible writer and incredible thinker. She was also a really caring person. And she and her sister grew up in poverty. They had an abusive father, and she was her sister's protector. And so even, when her sister grew up and had mental health issues, she supported her. And I know it really weighed on her throughout her life, but I think that's part of the reason why, that along with the fact that, she would often get herself into these situations of being a literary editor for a California Review. And she just poured her whole heart into it because she cared so much about other writers and community. It was such an important part of how she was a writer in this world. And same thing with her relationship with James Wong Hao. So it was a complicated relationship. I mean, very, very affected by the fact that James Wong Hao experienced incredible racism as a Chinese and then Chinese American living in the Los Angeles area. And they could not have a relationship together legally until the 1940s. It was
illegal. It's amazing. Yeah. Well, not so amazing when you think about the history of California, but that we forget that there was an anti-miscegenation law in California that applied to Chinese white relationships. They couldn't be married. And even living together was fraught for them.
Yeah. And the contracts that Jimmy had with the, he was a cinematographer, and all of his studio contracts listed that he could not live with her, like live with a white woman.
Yeah. Right. Because that would be scandalous we get the studio in trouble.
Exactly. I mean, and that really was, I mean, I think that's an important part when we look at, it's hard to look at their relationship and not think of it from the terms that we see it in our modern day, to not think like, why was it so complicated, their relationship? Right. But they both came from really, really troubled backgrounds. They both had traumatic childhood experiences. And so the way that their relationship developed was complicated. I think Jimmy did hold back Sonora Babb in some ways from reaching her potential as a writer, like being able to write more. I mean, I think she reached her potential, but I think at the same time, she also willingly took on that caregiving role and wouldn't have given it up, I don't think, for anyone. And I would love, if I could speak to her today, these are the questions I would ask her.
Right. No, I think you're right. At least from what I read in your book, it sounded like she was a willing caregiver and a willing communitarian, which kind of relates also to her political views, and that also relates back to maybe one of the reasons why she was less well known, or has been less well known, because in the 30s she joined the Communist Party and was part of the Writers' Congress, which was a leftist writers' organization. And later that became problematical, as many people now know, and in Hollywood and in other places, you had to suppress your political views, and hers evolved. I think it's fair to say that, by the 50s and 60s, she was still progressive, but not necessarily as committed to communism as she had been.
Yeah, well, I think, I think it's important to note that when Sonora Babb came to, she grew up in Oklahoma and Eastern Colorado, and then finally left her family, got on the train. Her dad flipped a coin and she decided to go to either New York or LA based on that coin flip, and ended up in LA. And when she was in LA in 1929, you know, there were some financial issues going on in the US, but she immediately connected with groups of writers. These young writers were pouring into Los Angeles from the Midwest, and all of them were poor. All of them were seeking, you know, wanted to become writers, and they became friends. And a lot of them found each other through the John Reed clubs, first of all, and then through the League of American Writers. And these communities really brought people together and lifted them up. And so that's why you see so many female writers, so many Black writers of the era, a part of these programs, because it was the first time ever that the publishing world was opening up to a much wider audience through the work of the Communist Party. And she also, you know, traveled to the Soviet Union as part of a tour in 1936. And she was given a tour that was largely guided by InTourist, which was kind of the propaganda tourism industry, right? And so Stalin's, like, you know, show trials are happening at exactly the same time, but she has no idea. And she's going to these model farms in what is now the Ukraine and seeing these, you know, a contrast to what she's seeing in America. So in America, right, she sees, you know, the Dust Bowl happening. It's begun. The Depression's begun. You have people, you know, people she knew in high school in Forgan, Oklahoma, that are completely destitute at this point. And so when she sees the model farms and she sees the government supporting farmers, she thinks, oh, this is the solution, you know? And she, that fueled her, that actually made her join the Communist Party. Like, she was a part of the groups before that, but once she saw these, like, government-based solutions and also saw the empowerment of women in the Soviet Union at the time that she saw through InTourist, she was totally sold. But it was after the war, you know, after the Red Scare happened, which she did have to go into exile because she was going to be called to testify and didn't want to, and knew that would affect her partner at the time, soon to be husband, James Wong Howe, his career as a cinematographer. And so she went and lived in Mexico City with a lot of the other expats in that community.
Her, I mean, it is amazing to me the number of people that she had contact with that I know of in other connections, you know, the John Fante and, but also the triumvirate for me of Tilly Olson, Maridel LeSueur, and Tom McGrath.
Yeah.
Who were, you know, I was fortunate enough to meet them in various contexts, you know, when they were still alive. I mean, they were pretty old, but they were heroes, you know, in a lot of ways to a lot of people who, you know, later, you know, as they got older, but they were part of that whole movement of radical writers of the 30s. And of course, now we can look back and say, as you kind of suggest, that they probably were taken in by the romanticism of the idea of communism and its potential for cooperative benefit, you know, for the greater good, where it was really, at that point, it was an authoritarian regime, but it was selling itself as something else.
Yeah. And its expression in the US was quite different than what was being, you know, what was happening in the Soviet Union at the time.
Yeah. But there was a, you know, by the 50s, it had changed, but she also changed, and but she suffered for it. And so, and James Wong Howe also was partly blacklisted. It sounded like his situation was better than
he was graylisted.
Because he was able to come back, you know, to work and not completely, as you said, exiled. You know, he might have, you know, had to step away a little while, but he was able to come back because partly he was so good.
Yeah. I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that Sonora left because they were being visited by the FBI quite a bit before she left. And so I think she helped him avoid further blacklisting with her action.
You didn't chase down the FBI file for her by any chance, did you?
You know, I'm on a list to get it. Someday they'll send it to me. But I did have notes of the FBI file from other scholars. So I haven't seen them directly. I've seen them in notation form.
It's amazing to think of that. It's kind of chilling to realize that wasn't that long ago. You know, it's certainly within memory of people who are alive today that we had a government that was spying on its own people.
It's terrifying. And when you hear the rhetoric of that time period, it is very haunting, mm-hmm. The McCarthy era.
And it affected a lot of writers because writers are dangerous. Words change people's minds. So,
and if you think about it, you know, something that's really, really terrifies me, David, is the idea that so many voices were erased because of the Red Scare. Like there are so many important voices that were, you know, completely lost to us from the 20s, 30s, and 40s because of the Red Scare. And I think we are just now recovering some of those voices. And it really terrifies me that something like that could happen again, where there would be another, you know, zeroing out. And what survives that kind of, you know, we lose a diversity of voices if that happens.
Right. And it also, it has what we know now is called the chilling effect. People self-censor. They will change subtly how they behave, how they write, out of fear, because you're not being afraid for wrong reasons. You know, it is the things that can happen to people are really damaging. And
the government took away people's passports, you know, like right away. They were exiled for the rest of their lives, many of the writers that Sonora associated with.
Yeah. So, in her, you know, we should definitely talk about the elephant in the room, the big, you know, as you called it before we started talking, the hook. This part of the story is always shocking, I think, when you think about it and talk to people about it. I'm sure you've talked to a lot of people about it, but that is the relationship of Sonora Babb's writing to the Grapes of Wrath. And she was in the late 30s, she was working as a volunteer in the Farm Security Administration. Do I have that right? In the camps, in the migrant camps in California.
That's correct. So 1938 to 39. After she got back from the Soviet Union, she reached out to Tom Collins, who was the person who opened up all of the camps in California, and asked him if she could work for him. And he was really excited to have her come work with him. And she ended up spending 9 months traveling around California, parts of Southern Oregon, helping him interview different refugees, finding out where they're from, what was going on, and then helping them get set in camps up and down the state. And these were democracy functioning. So the idea was that they were running them, that the people, the refugees were running them themselves. And so they were, otherwise she knew and he knew that it wouldn't work, that these people were proud and they weren't taking handouts. And so the idea was that she helped them set up committees and helped them set up newsletters and dances and things like that, so that it felt like a normal environment. But it was a time when she was just completely devoted to her work. If you see photographs of her at the camps, she's like in the mix of it, like sitting in the middle of a group of people. That she has all these letters in her files from refugees that got on their feet years later and thanked her for what she did. And while she was there, she was working on her first novel called Whose Names Are Unknown. And it's a novel based a lot on experiences from her past growing up in the panhandle of Oklahoma and in Eastern Colorado. She lived in a dugout with her family farming broom corn. So she knew what it was like to struggle from crop to crop. And she really connected with these people. And so she's writing this amazing novel, Whose Names Are Unknown, which is set in Oklahoma for you know, a year or two before the dust storms happen. So you really get to know the people there before they have to leave everything and migrate to California. And she sends her first four chapters out to Bennett Cerf at Random House. And he loved it and sent her a contract. And so she's really excited. This is her first novel. And she spends, she keeps working at the camps and is collecting notes. And in the spring of 1938, her boss, Tom Collins, asked her to go to a cafe with John Steinbeck, who was visiting the camps to do research for his own novel. And he'd already done two versions of this novel, but he didn't like what the results were and had started again. And so they met up at a cafe, and she, because of Tom Collins, handed over all of her notes that she'd been taking for her novel and also for the camp. And he, Steinbeck took those notes, and he was at this place in his writing process that he was starting anew. And he was so grateful because those notes really informed the writing of his book, which he did very quickly. So The Grapes of Wrath was written in 5 months, which is amazing. Largely with the help of Elaine, John Steinbeck's wife was also helping him like edit along the way. And also these notes, which he recorded as being really important to the work that he was doing. And so Steinbeck gets his work out. Meanwhile, Sonora Babb stays at the camps working. She leaves in the winter of 1939 and then ends up that spring going to New York to finish her book. And gets these great notes from Bennett Cerf. He's like, I can't wait to read the full manuscript. The reader's reports are great. She goes to turn it in. And when she walks in to meet with him, Bennett Cerf has totally cleared his entire desk. And just on the middle of the desk is a check. And she knows immediately that something's really wrong. And he says to her, I'm really sorry, but 3 weeks ago, The Grapes of Wrath was published by John Steinbeck. And it was a bestseller immediately, sold over, I think, 300,000 copies or something right away, 200,000 copies. And was given a movie contract within the first year that it came out, and which became an Academy Award-winning movie. So Bennett Cerf is like, I'm sorry, we're going to have to cancel your contract because your books are almost identical on the second half of the book. And Sonora Babb is like, what? I can't believe this. Like when she gets the reader's reports, they're like, you know, this is a great book, but it's too much like Steinbeck's. And so she leaves New York completely devastated, doesn't write for a year, but does write again. And, you know, she keeps trying to get her book out there, but no one wants to take it because the Grapes of Wrath just becomes the single story to represent the Dust Bowl almost immediately. And even though Sonora Babb's book is so different and has such a different perspective, I mean, it's set in Oklahoma and before the Dust Bowls happen. And then in California, you see people in the camps. It's not just white people. It's actually like California actually is diverse. There's Filipino workers, Black workers, Mexican workers all in the fields together. There's a strike and an uprising. I mean, it's completely different, but the victims actually have agency. You know, they're the survivors of the Dust Bowl have agency, and I think that's a huge difference. And what she kept telling people was the difference between their books. But because of that, Sonora Babb's book did not get published, whose names are unknown, until 2004, 20 years ago. It is out. You can read it. And if you join my Substack, Finding Lost Voices, you can actually get a reading guide now because I'm trying to get more people to read it.
Well, I did read it, and I agree, you know, with you. It was striking what you said. Also, I noticed that Steinbeck credited Tom Collins,
yes,
but did not credit Sonora Babb. So, you know, you have to wonder whether, you know, whether there was something going on there. Like he knew that he had stolen not the writing, but the idea, you know, the kind of the guts of his book in a way from her notes and didn't give her credit for that.
Yeah. I don't know that he was conscious of the fact that, that she was writing a novel. That's not, we don't know.
No, I don't even mean that, but he didn't even credit her for the notes.
No, I know. I mean, I think he thought he was crediting, you know, the organization by crediting Tom Collins, which, you know, at the time he would have thought, well, she just works for him. She's a woman. Not really that.
Right. Well, that's, yeah, the inherent sexism of that era, definitely. Yeah.
Sadly. And he also called himself a magpie. That was like what he called himself. And it was not only her work that he appropriated. There were other instances that have been well documented by scholars.
Yeah. And he's not alone in being, you know, writers are at it. Writers are always living on the shoulders of the people who went before them, or sometimes it's purely inspirational. Totally. And sometimes really valuable inspiration that you don't even recognize as a writer, you know, that read something or listen to some music. You know, I think a lot of musicians or songwriters have this problem too, because you hear a song and it may change the way you think about music, and then you're writing a different song, and the person who wrote the first song could say, wait a minute, you know?
I think there's a difference though between like an almost adaptation of content to making something so similar that the other thing can't be published.
But he didn't do it. You're saying he didn't do that on purpose. It was accidental, but it happened.
I think he appropriated the content and didn't think that it mattered that he appropriated her content. She was not an established writer, and she would not publish a novel until 1958. And so, and she would never publish Whose Names Are Unknown while he was still alive. So he died in the 60s.
And didn't she have to rewrite like crazy? I mean, what you recounted both for that book, for Whose Names Are Unknown, but also the other books, felt like kind of overbearing, intrusive editorial work by the publishers who were interested in publishing her, where they wanted her to change the books to such a degree that they wouldn't really be what she was trying to write anymore.
Well, that's an important thing to talk about, is that when she left New York, she left with a new contract, right? So she had to start all new with a new first novel. And so she went back to writing about her childhood. And she wrote about living in Garden City, Kansas, in where her dad was, you know, a full-time gambler at that point, and she's marking cards for him. And it's a coming of age story, which has a lot of like female sexuality and independence. It's, you know, it's called The Lost Traveler. And it's the 1950s when she is writing this book. And you can imagine that the feedback she's getting from the male editor is asking her to, you know, like simmer down the independence of Robin, the main character,
Get rid of the sexual agency.
Right? Yeah, right. Yeah, and the independence of it, like in like the agency in that, you know, right. And then also the idea that the editor thought the father was too abusive and it was unbelievable. And that was just devastating to Bab, because she had toned it down. You know, her father was a difficult man. And, you see it also in Al, like in the in Al on Every Post is her memoir about her time growing up in Eastern Colorado in that dugout that I was talking about earlier. And when she writes that, she really romanticizes the her experiences there. If you read the early chapters of my book, it's a very different version of that era. Right. And I think that was her way of she realized that the world didn't want to read the reality. You know, when she was writing Lost Traveler, it was too painful for the world to, you know, at the time, to be receptive of the fact that a young girl could survive that and remain independent and remain, you know, she had this incredible fortitude, you know, that she could survive that and thrive.
She was extraordinary in that way. Also, I think the fact that she was, and this sort of goes back to the relationship with James Wong Howe, that she didn't want to have a monogamous relationship with him. She wanted her freedom and wanted to, you know, potentially see other people and have friendships and even sexual relationships with other people. You know, at a time we think back on as being less open, but of course it wasn't. But it, you know, it was, she wasn't unique, but she was singular, I think, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it's really fascinating to me when we think about looking back, you know, women, we think that the sexual relationships of people in the 1900s or something were totally different than they are now, right, which is not true. You know, like the one thing I've learned about writing biographies, like about Charmian Kittredge London and Jack London's lives, is people had different types of relationships throughout history. And I think it's just now that people are more open about that in their lives. And so I think that it's shocking to many people to find out that Sonora Babb didn't want a monogamous relationship. But I think there's a lot of factors that went into play in regards to that beyond just her sexuality. I think it was also the fact that she didn't want to get married because she'd seen what marriage did to her mother. Her mother was in an abusive marriage. She was married at 15. You know, so she didn't really, you know, have a childhood. It got cut off by becoming a wife and then a mother in a very controlled state.
But it is also important to note that her mother finally did divorce the father.
Yes,
and she got to have a life of her own. And I think her, you know, this whole idea of survival and strength, you know, that's a pretty great story.
Yeah, it is. Jenny was pretty amazing, her mother.
So I know this right now, as we're talking, your book is out and you're doing a lot of promotion for it. So you're probably talking more about this book now than you will later. But I wanted to ask you about what your plans are for your next book. And I've been reading your Substack. I really like it. You know, you talk about people that I'm really interested in, but who's next? You know, who are, do you have somebody else in mind?
Well, I've been, part of the reason why I started Finding Lost Voices was, which is my Substack, was because I realized that in my lifetime, I'll be able to maybe write 10 biographies if I'm really lucky, you know, if I live a long time and I can stick with it. And that's really not enough for me. And so I started the Substack so that I can bring out the voices of women who have been forgotten every week. And it's been amazing. I mean, the community's grown to like over 3,000 people. It's really wonderful. And I also showcase parts of our community that are doing the same work and bringing back women's voices. But as far as who I'm working on now, I'm in the process of finding different subjects. I've thought about writing about Hansel Meath, who was a photographer who came from Germany, escaped Germany, and ended up living in Sonoma County at the end of her life. But she worked for Life magazine as a photographer and took some of the most striking photos. Really political photos of the last century, including of internment camps that Life magazine wouldn't print. And so she ended up living in exile in Sonoma County and also being ousted because of the Red Scare. So she's a possible subject. But I'm also working on a book that's a little bit different. It's called Strong, and it's about women, the vaudeville strong women. And I'm looking at kind of how that shaped our concept of what strong-bodied women, how they were perceived in society up through Muscle Beach and everything. Because I'm an athlete as well, and so it's been fascinating to me to see how that's kind of shifted, that muscly women are kind of more accepted but also still not accepted in our society.
Right. That's a really interesting idea I would not have ever thought of. So it's good. Well, I really want to thank you, Iris. This has been great fun for me. And I really enjoyed this book. I enjoyed reading Sonora's novel. Now I'm looking forward to reading her memoir, which I think will be really interesting. So thank you for making Sonora Babb's life more public and more accessible. It's really appreciated.
Well, thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Thanks. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk. I've been talking to Iris Jamal Dunkel about her new book, Riding Like the Wind, The Life of Sonora Babb. Thank you all.